we are truly, truly honored to have one of Britain's leading economic historians with us today. Scott Newton, who's a professor emeritus from the University of Cardiff. His publications are vast, and he's speaking to us today about Kim Philby and a new way of understanding him. Thank you very much for speaking.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Am I loud and clear? Is that okay? Oh, fine. Good. Okay. Well, few people in the history of espionage have had their public careers and private lives so thoroughly dissected as Kim Philby. I would think most of you know the story very well, but I will do a brief resume. He was a classic product of the British establishment, son of the maverick Arabist St. John Philby, and he was educated at Westminster and then Trinity College, Cambridge. After a spell in journalism, including a short time in Spain, well, more than a short time, some years in Spain, reporting on the Spanish Civil War from Franco's side, he was recruited into MI6 in 1940. And he worked full-time for MI6, or SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, from 1940 until 1951. And won a reputation for being intelligent, competent, and clubbable. Between 1944 and 1947, he was head of Section 9 of SIS, a section he was actually instrumental in setting up, and it was designed to spy on the Soviet Union and gather intelligence about Soviet operations. From 1949 to 1951, he was posted to Washington and worked as the SIS liaison officer with the CIA. He appeared to be destined for a top job in SIS, but was forced to resign in the wake of the Burgess and Maclean defections to the Soviet Union in 1951. That was a result of Philby's friendship with Guy Burgess. He was rehired as a part-timer while working as a Middle Eastern correspondent based in Beirut for The Observer between 1956 and 1963, before finally, in 1963, departing for Moscow. And once there, he announced he'd been a Soviet agent since the 1930s. Now, Philby died over 30 years ago, but anyone who Googles his name will quickly accumulate a mountain of material still coming out today, and the majority of these are very critical, and he's portrayed as disloyal to his country, to his agents, to his colleagues, as a willing servant of the Soviet Union, of Stalinist and post-Stalinist Soviet Union. He is accused of leaking prodigious volumes of American secrets, British and American secrets, I beg your pardon, to Moscow throughout the 1940s. These included a comprehensive breakdown of SIS organization, character sketches of its officers, along with descriptions of the jobs they did, details of Western operations designed to bring, designed to destabilize Soviet influence on Eastern Europe after 1945, notably in the Baltic states, and in Ukraine and Albania. He was apparently the model for Bill Hayden in John le Carré's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Publicity for a two-part BBC Two documentary about Kim Philby, which gets re-aired from time to time, based on Ben McIntyre's book, A Spy Among Friends, described him, the publicity described him, as a fanatic and a ruthless killer who deceived everyone around him. One CIA officer said that from 1944 to 51, the entire Western intelligence effort, which was pretty big, was what you might call a minus advantage. We'd have been better off doing nothing. On top of this, as if that wasn't enough, Philby is described as a drunkard and philanderer, who betrayed his wives and his friends, and his many private infidelities complementing his political treason. To use an old public school phrase, which would have been familiar to Filby, this man was a cad and a bounder. His career not only ruined lives, but damaged his country and destroyed the reputation of the British Intelligence Service for years. Now, that's been the accepted picture for a very long time, despite some attempts to write the balance, if you might say, from writers like Philip Knightley and indeed Philby's third wife in Russia, who wrote a book about him and their life together. But these books haven't had much attention, nor has one source, which I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about today, which was a recent publication by Tim Milne, a name which may not be familiar to many of you, but Tim Milne was a colleague of Filby's in SIS. They were the same age, and Milne's book came out, it was written in the late 1970s, a biography of Filby, an account of their relationship, an account of Filby's work, and an analysis and an appraisal of what he did and what damage he might have done. It didn't actually get published until 2014 because he didn't get permission to publish it, and it came out about 3 years after his death. Now, Milne was recruited on Filby's recommendation. They were very good friends. They'd been friends at school. They used to go on holidays together. And although Ben McIntyre places Filby's friendship with Nicholas Elliott at the centre of his version of the Filby story, in reality, Filby's oldest and closest friend in the service and outside the service for many years was Tim Milne. And Milne has produced a very good piece of work with a lot of new information in it. And it's very well written, and I urge you to try and find it. It didn't get anything like as much publicity as Ben McIntyre's book, but it's far better and far more accurate. And it's very well written and humorous into the bargain, as befits someone who was actually the great nephew, I think, of A.A. Milne. His account of life in SIS and Section 5, which Filby was part of and became head of, Milne's account of his time with Filby in Section 5 is during the war, is interesting in its depiction of the department's informality, the good relations between staff, its general efficiency. Milne points out that Filby, who rose, of course, as we know, to a senior position, had a lot to do with this. He was hardworking, easy to work for, unstuffy, understanding, and good company both in the office and the pub. The Filby who emerges from this narrative is a long way away from the louche figure who features in so many studies. He is not a serial adulterer, and while clearly enjoying a drink, certainly not an alcoholic. The closest he came to that was after he defected, which was a period Milne doesn't write about. He's a good colleague, a loyal and supportive friend, a loving father. He reads widely, appreciates classical music, and enjoys cricket. An interesting and intelligent and actually rather decent man emerges from this, very different from the stereotype. These are not the only points about this analysis which contradict the conventional wisdom. Others concern his career as a Soviet agent. First, of course, briefly, there is the story of Filby's so-called right-wing period in the mid to late 1930s, when it is said he was persuaded by his Soviet controller, having just joined the Soviet intelligence system, to pose as a right-winger so that he could infiltrate the British establishment. So he quickly dropped his pro-communist early Cambridge pro-socialist and pro-communist feelings and moved to the right, it is said, with great alacrity and great drama. Well, not great drama, but surprising his friends. But Milne says that actually this isn't true. Milne did not pick up any particularly right-wing sentiment in Filby during these years at all. And in fact, he remained strongly anti-Mussolini. He just noted that he appeared to be a bit more on the fence than he had been 5 or 6 years earlier. Another case where the official's narrative doesn't stand up, concerns work in Section 5 during the war. This was a story put about by the historian Hugh Trevor Roper, that Philby suppressed reports. Section 5 dealt with counterintelligence about the German intelligence system and German efforts to penetrate British intelligence systems, counterintelligence. And Hugh Trevor Roper, another colleague in the SIS, the distinguished historian, wrote in an essay about Philby that during the war, Kim Philby suppressed reports from German sources suggesting that senior figures in the German Army High Command were at loggerheads with the Nazis, and that there were important dissidents in the Abwehr, the German intelligence service. That's what Philby is accused of doing, suppressing these reports. It's said that he blocked the distribution of these documents from anti-Nazi figures, such as Hans Gisevius, Otto Jahn, and Adam von Trott. He blocked them because he didn't want to encourage the idea that there were figures in Germany with whom Britain could negotiate. And he wanted, in tune with his Soviet masters, for the fighting to go on until the German system was completely destroyed and the inconformity with Soviet determination that any peace which would leave the fighting on the Eastern Front to stop short of the total destruction of Germany should be sabotaged. So any separate peace proposals which emanated from Germany were, it is said, blocked by Philby. And so were attempts to undermine Hitler, that were calling for British assistance. Mill disputes this. He points out, first of all, that material from the German dissidents did circulate in SIS. Secondly, that Philby was in no position to stop this and would only have drawn attention to himself if he had done. Thirdly, if Philby had taken against Trevor Roper's views, which Mill says he can't remember happening at all, the whole of Section 5 would actually have supported him. And fourthly, that aversion to treating with German groups apparently willing to move against Hitler was general in London after the disaster, an intelligence disaster at the beginning of the war, called the Venlo Affair, which I'm afraid I haven't got any. Perhaps if there's time afterwards I can go into it, but I haven't got time at the moment. And finally, that in any case, it was the Foreign Office where the strongest opposition to linking up with any opposition to Hitler could be found, given that it was a fixed Allied policy to reject anything that could be seen as driving a wedge between the Russians and the Anglo-Americans. Thirdly, Mill also suggests that the damage done by Philby to British interests has been exaggerated. During the war, he argues that it can be said that what Philby did was good for British interests, that it was good that he passed information to the Soviet Union, given that Britain and the Soviet Union were allies, and that Soviet scepticism about the genuine good faith and trustworthiness of Churchill, given Churchill's history in relations with the Soviet Union, given Soviet scepticism about Churchill's trustworthiness, notwithstanding many assurances of friendship during the war, these could be mitigated, this Soviet scepticism could be mitigated by secret intelligence passed to them by Philby and others, especially if it confirmed that there was no anti-Soviet deal with Germany on the cards. Milne admits that after Philby moved to Section 9, the anti-Soviet section in 1944, the balance shifted and his position and what he did became harmful. But even the impact of that has been exaggerated. When he took over Section 9, as head of this anti-Soviet section, Philby was not in a position to tell the Russians everything, nor to sabotage every action, every operation against them. Had he done so, he would have incriminated himself, and his career would have come to an abrupt halt. If Philby was going to remain of use to the Soviets, there were times when he had to use his discretion, and keep material from them, even if it was extremely important. And indeed, he admitted many years later that this is exactly what he had done. Moreover, there would have been occasions when the KGB itself failed to act on information provided by Philby in order to stop him becoming a suspect of leaking. Mill's book shows, however, that KGB willingness to protect Philby was not evident at all during the Burgess and McLean affair. Was this incompetence? Or, as Mill interestingly suggests, was there a bigger picture, one which made it essential that McLean and possibly Philby be sacrificed, even in a very clumsy manner, in order to protect another, a more senior informant, someone we've Milne speculates about, but we haven't heard the name of this person. Finally, Milne argues that Philby's use to the Soviets after 1951 must have been nil or vestigial, and that his work for them in the Middle East would not have involved reporting on the ins and outs of what was happening in SIS, but just in most cases been tittle-tattle gossip and analyses of the strategic position in the Middle East, something an experienced journalist, as Philby was of course, would have been in a good position to do. Overall, his chief value to the Soviets was that he was there and in a position to warn Soviet intelligence between 1940 and the early 1950s about the most important moves against its agents and its position in Eastern Europe after the war. Even when there were times, of course, when Philby didn't actually do that, because it was not politic. So, we've got two Philby discourses. The conventional wisdom, which continues to generate deeply hostile accounts of Philby, and the latest is, of course, the Ben McIntyre business, which has been on television recently as a drama. And that's just the latest in a long line of lurid books and stories and films which have been coming out about Philby since the late 1960s. Milne's analysis joins the work of writers in the more pro category, such as Graham Greene, Philip Knightley, Eleanor Philby, Philby's wife from 1957 to 68. She died in the end in the USA. Rufina Philby, Philby's wife from 1971 until he died in 1988. And the former CIA officer, Hayden Peake. And the Soviet journalist, Genrikh Borovich. These depict him more sympathetically and refrain from moralizing condemnations of his personal conduct and his treachery, generally seeking to explain and place this within the historical context of his lifetime. These writers stress the depth of his commitment to communism and to the struggle against fascism and Nazism, made when these appeared indeed to be on the verge of plunging the world into a new dark age. The evidence suggests that the sympathetic discourse is a good deal nearer the truth. This is my analysis of it anyway. The sympathetic discourse is a good deal nearer the truth than the hostile one, although it's essential to add the qualification that certainty about the full story of Kim Philby and his activities, certainty continues to be a little bit elusive. There can be no doubt that Philby's work for the Soviet Union provided important intelligence to Moscow. When discussing his career with Soviet journalist Genrikh Borovich during the 80s, Philby himself mentioned three cases where he felt he'd done something important for them. One was a survey of SIS intelligence and personnel, a very full one, which he provided during the war, along with an account of SIS's material on the Abwehr, which he came across when he was at Section 5. A second was information he provided to the Soviet Union about the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the American intelligence service set up in 1942, I think 41 or 42, which later became the CIA. And that was information about the early years of the OSS, some of whose staff were posted to London. Section 5 of SIS in particular worked closely with the OSS, providing Philby with an opportunity to tell Moscow about Anglo-American intelligence collaboration and targets. A third case study that Philby mentioned concerned Anglo-American cooperation on the atom bomb and the possibility that Washington's possession of this weapon would be used to try and force the Soviets to collaborate with American interests after the war. In addition to these can be added the overview, but it wasn't much more than an overview in many cases, which I'll come to in a little bit, the overview Philby was able to provide of Anglo-American strategy and anti-Soviet operations in the Balkans and Eastern Europe during the early Cold War years. Now that's undoubtedly an incomplete list, but it amounts to a formidable one. All the same, we now know, quite apart from the qualifications Milne introduced, there were times when Philby, by design and by accident, so it seems, although that's not entirely clear really, was not in touch with his Soviet contacts at all. For example, he was appalled by the Nazi-Soviet Pact of August 1939. Communication with Moscow became increasingly sporadic until it was broken off. He broke off contact. The Russians lost touch with him completely for well over a year, partly from his disapproval of what had happened and partly from fear that any information he handed over to Moscow would find its way to Nazi Germany. He was, at this time, in 1939 and into 1940, not in SIS, but working as a war correspondent with the Times in France. There was another gap in 1949 and 1950, after Philby's transfer to Washington, to become SIS CIA liaison officer. And this is very surprising. It was actually 9 or 10 months, apparently, according to Borovitch, after Philby's transfer to Washington, 9 or 10 months before the KGB was in touch with him. A very strange turn of events, and the reasons for this are obscure. But as a result, in one of the most tense periods of the Cold War, the early Cold War, Moscow would have received little or nothing or information at indirect routes from Philby about the progress of, for example, the Anglo-American investigation into the leakage of atomic secrets to the Soviet Union, nor about Anglo-American intelligence relations, nor about Western attempts to stir up anti-communist nationalist movements in the USSR and Eastern Europe. It's also clear that a number of Western intelligence disasters attributed to Philby either did not happen at all, or if they did, were not down to interventions on his part, or not principally so. And I've got three examples. And they're all cases used to justify the argument that Philby was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of agents working with British intelligence. The first is the Vermeeren affair. Vermeeren. This followed from the defection of senior Abwehr officer Erich Vermeeren and his wife Elizabeth to the Allies in 1944. This case is said to have been one explanation for the deep hostility or animosity to Philby on the part of many intelligence officers. The Vermeerens, who were Catholics, had been part of an anti-Nazi resistance network, which included co-religionists, and they handed over to the British a list identifying many of their colleagues in this network. After the war, officers from MI5 travelled to Germany trying to find these people, these very brave people, but failed to locate one of them. Ben McIntyre provides an account of this based on information from MI5. This was that Philby had handed the names over to his controllers, the Soviet controllers, and that Soviet intelligence had hunted these people down and eliminated them in order to remove alternative sources of political influence in Germany after the war. But the real story is told in an article, a recent one actually, by Nigel West, who found that the Vermeerens identified actually six anti-Nazis to MI5. Three of them were executed by the Nazis for their involvement in the plot to assassinate Hitler in July 1944. And as for the others, the fate of one, a Dr. Wilbrandt, is not known. But the other two, Franz Hander and Ernst Junger, died in 1972 and 1998, respectively, of natural causes. There's no evidence at all that Philby betrayed the group. Next, there is Operation Valuable, which ran from the late 40s until the early 50s. And this was the attempt to overthrow the communist government in Albania, which Philby is said to have been closely involved with. It was about parachuting partisans into the country to link up with local resistance networks and perform sabotage operations. But most of the people who went were captured and either shot or sent to prison. And Philby's been routinely blamed for this, accused of blowing all the information about the landing sites and the timing of the operations, that he used his position for SIS in Washington to pass all this on to Moscow. And they had everything they needed to be waiting with the Albanians for the resistance groups as they turned up either landing from the sea or from the air. And hundreds of lives are said to have been lost. Now, this is all rather fanciful. For a start, the Albanian affair began in 1948, when Philby was working in Istanbul and not in a position to know much of it. He was SIS head of station in Istanbul at the time. He didn't arrive in Washington, of course, until the autumn of 1949, and then had no direct contact with the KGB for months. It would have been mid-1950 before he would have been able, well, the spring of 1950, let's put it that way, at the earliest, before he would have been able to say very much, if anything, about Albania. What really seems to have happened was that at some point, Philby told his contact about the Albanian operation and its objectives in general terms. Even if he had had access to detailed information, he did not pass this on, because if he'd done so, it would have exposed him. In his biography of Philby, Philip Knightley, who, as you know, or some of you may know, actually knew him and went out to Moscow to meet him, Philip Knightley reports that the failure of Operation Valuable stemmed from the penetration of Albanian emigre organisations by the Albanian Security Service. And more than one of three penetration agents managed to be selected for the SIS-CIA operation. Some years after this, in 2013, Knightley actually told me the following. He said, "Of course, Philby would not have known the operational details for the Albanian drops, and even if he had, would not have risked revealing them. By chance," Knightley went on, "some years ago, I met the former head of the Albanian counterintelligence service in London at a party. I questioned him about the Albanian operation. He claimed that neither Philby nor the KGB had anything to do with the operation's failure, and that his service had long penetrated the rebels' ranks. He would say that, wouldn't he? But I tend to believe him." Finally, there is the Volkov affair. This occurred in 1945, when Konstantin Volkov, Soviet vice consul in Istanbul, indicated to the British that he wished to defect. Now, accounts of this say that he was going to come over with a lot of very, very important information, that he was going to name, for example, 314 Soviet agents in Turkey, 250 working in official and secret organisations in Britain, and stated in addition there were seven KGB sources in the Foreign Office and two in the British Intelligence Service. Philby, clearly threatened, headed for Istanbul in his capacity as head of the anti-Soviet Section 9, and he headed there to meet Volkov himself. Before leaving London, he tipped off Moscow about the would-be defector, and by the time he reached Istanbul, Volkov had disappeared. It is widely assumed that Volkov was seized by the Soviets and transported back to Moscow, where he was interrogated and executed. The outcome was a source of bad feeling towards Philby in SIS. When he wrote to Nicholas Elliott from Moscow, suggesting a meeting in neutral Helsinki after he'd defected, Elliott is said to have replied with a rather contemptuous note, saying that he wouldn't meet him, but put some flowers for me on Volkov's grave in response. There's little doubt that Philby did tell his controllers about Volkov, or that the latter was removed from Istanbul as a result. Beyond that point, things become rather murky. For a start, Volkov's offer of defection included not a list of 250 Soviet agents working in Britain, but of 250 British intelligence officers whose identities were known to the Soviet Union. Furthermore, his information about KGB sources was far less specific than the history books say. It referred to 9 in the Foreign Office and Intelligence Services, but did not specify how many or who they were or which working in which departments. It was very general. Furthermore, and this is the most surprising thing, it is not even certain that Volkov was executed. Todor Boyev, a now retired senior member of Bulgarian intelligence, who became friendly with Philby in the 1970s and 80s and published a book about him, was told, and put this in the book, on the basis of material in the KGB archives, that Volkov was not shot but jailed for 10 years and then released. Really quite a surprising turn of events, if that is the case. It is odd, unless of course the whole Volkov affair was a KGB provocation to test Philby's loyalty. It's something I'll come on to soon. Whatever the truth about the Volkov affair, all in all it seems clear that some of the more spectacular claims about the impact of Philby's work for Soviet intelligence have been exaggerated, often with the help of SIS and the CIA. As Philip Knightley told me, and I'm quoting, "It's been standard Western intelligence agency practice for a long while that when a penetration agent is uncovered, you unload on him all the blame for every unsolved scandal." The discrepancy between Philby's real life and the conventional wisdom continued during the Moscow years. It was reported that he was a senior KGB officer, that he had a desk in the KGB headquarters in Lyubyanka. In fact, he had no official position in the KGB at all, though he had a generous pension. And he was regarded simply as an agent. He wasn't an officer, he was an agent. There was no room at the Lyubyanka, which he only visited once in 1977 to give a talk. Once his debriefing was over and he'd finished his memoir, which became published as My Silent War, he didn't have much to do at all. He became lonely and seems to have hit the bottle. Anxiety about his mental state led the KGB to decide to use his skills so that from the mid-70s, for about 10 years, it consulted him on operational matters occasionally, or perhaps a bit more than that, and with its backing, he established a training program and seminars for KGB officers who were to be posted to Britain to help them blend in there. The truth was that the KGB never really trusted Philby. Some in the organisation suspected that he, along with Blunt, Burgess and Cairncross, all, of course, high-profile Soviet intelligence agencies who penetrated the British system, they suspected that Philby, along with them, had been a British agent from the start, all along, providing the Soviets with chicken feed and disinformation. This went all the way back to the wartime period when one analyst, Elena Modrishskaya, argued that it was incredible that SIS would recruit someone with a known communist past and promote him to a senior position. Skepticism increased even more when, in answer to repeated queries about SIS plans to mount operations against the Soviet Union and run agents there, when he was repeatedly asked about this during the wartime years, Philby answered that there were no plans and the agents did not exist, at least not up to this formation of Section 9. During a large part of Philby's time in Section 5, Philby's controllers in Moscow were more interested in asking him to fill in forms and write up his life story than in the information he was passing to them. In the end, the KGB decided not to abandon dealing with Philby and the others, not because they concluded that these people were genuine after all, but one, because they couldn't prove that they were double agents conclusively, and two, because some of the information being provided really was valuable. But the doubts were never dispelled. And Philby's conduct in Moscow did not dispel this distrust. His early years there coincided with a Khrushchev thaw, when Soviet economic growth was robust and there was more freedom of expression in the Soviet Union than there had been since the 1920s. Then after Khrushchev's fall from power, things started to change. And during the 70s and 80s, the economic progress of the post-war era slowed down and finally ground to a halt. In the Soviet Union, there developed obvious signs of poverty on the streets, shortages of consumer goods, and the political climate became more and more repressive. Within the Eastern Bloc of nations, Czechoslovakia, where there had been some dramatic moves towards liberalisation, was invaded by Soviet forces in 1968. Dissidents and writers who did not toe the Communist Party line in Russia, the line as set out by Brezhnev and Kosygin, dissidents who did not toe that party line were hounded. The work of Solzhenitsyn, of course, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, which had become available during the Khrushchev years, was suppressed. Solzhenitsyn was expelled from the Writers' Union and forced to work in secret. And early in 1974, after years of harassment, he was deported to West Germany. Another leading citizen, the physicist Andrei Sakharov, known as the father of the Soviet H-bomb, was banished from his home in Moscow and sent into internal exile after criticizing Soviet nuclear strategy and campaigning for human rights. Solzhenitsyn and Sakharov were the most famous victims of the post-Khrushchev freeze, but there were many other dissidents who lived under a shadow during this time. Philby knew much about this, given his KGB connections and his wife's contacts in dissident circles. And it disgusted him. He was appalled by the treatment of Solzhenitsyn, whose work he displayed openly on his bookshelves after it had been banned. He angrily refused to sign official documents condemning dissidents, thought the Cold War a charade, and disagreed openly with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. He was frank about all this and other issues with KGB colleagues and told them, in terms, you would do better to go after the real criminals instead of persecuting dissidents. On top of this, he became increasingly disappointed with the material reality of Soviet life, noting the contrast between the privations suffered by ordinary citizens, especially pensioners and war veterans, and the affluence and corruption in senior party circles. His willingness to speak his mind about this reinforced the paranoid school of opinion about him in the KGB and led to the temporary suspension of his training sessions and seminars. It was claimed that in the opinion, and I'm quoting from the account of this period in his life by Hayden Peak, I think it is, it was claimed that in the opinion of senior management, Philby had turned into a dissident, was criticising Soviet life, and might even be seeking to leave for the West. Well, he never did leave, as far as we know. He never did leave, of course, although interestingly, when living in Moscow in the last 10 years of his life, he did remark to his wife, Rufina, that as he put it, he knew everything, but he was too old to start all over again. KGB suspicions were encouraged by Philby's obvious and persistent Englishness. He listened to the BBC World Service every day, followed cricket. He had a copy of the 1972 Wisden Cricketers' Almanac on his shelves, and had the complete works of P.G. Wodehouse in his extensive library, topped up by mail ordering from the Cambridge bookseller Bowes and Bowes, which he'd used from the time he'd been a student. After Philby's death, some of his colleagues speculated that he'd always had two loyalties, one to SIS and the other to the KGB. As one of his KGB colleagues said, he could have worked honestly for both sides without being a double agent, effectively using his own judgment and discretion about what to do with the information he possessed. In 2010, Russia's post-KGB Foreign Intelligence Service unveiled a plaque to Philby at its Moscow headquarters, and it depicted him with two faces, one going that way, one going that way, as the two-faced Roman god of gates, Janus. Philby's misgivings about the Soviet Union were not new. They flared up from time to time throughout his life, but he never repudiated his commitment to communism. As a young man, Philby had made this not because he wanted to spy for the Soviet Union, nor because he hated his own country. He certainly did not. In fact, one of the most sensible comments I've heard about Philby in recent times was made to me by the novelist Edward Wilson, who said that, in his opinion, Philby was actually a patriotic, cricket-loving Englishman who happened to be a communist. Nor because he hated his own country, certainly not, but because he possessed a keen sense of injustice and saw communism as the key to fighting fascism and imperialism and building a better and fairer world. The circumstances of the time when he made this commitment led him to become a Soviet agent. This career did not lead him to become an uncritical supporter of Stalinism and the party line, and in fact he never joined the Communist Party anyway. In the final analysis, he saw himself not as a political man, but as a foot soldier in the long struggle to improve the lot of humanity, above all of the underdog. And like soldiers everywhere, he did not have to agree with the thinking in his army's high command. And a footnote here, in 1988, when Philip Knightley's biography of Philby was published, only a very short time after Philby died, I went to the publishing party at André Deutsch, and I met Philby's son John and his daughter Josephine, and had an interesting conversation with them both. And at one point, John Philby turned to me and said, "Of course, you know, my father wasn't really a very political man at all." And it was all I could do to look at him and say, "Come again." But but he explained that this was the point, that Philby saw himself as a foot soldier, as someone who was slogging away for a cause, but not a high level political operator. And like soldiers everywhere, he did not have to agree with the thinking in his army's high command. It's obvious even from a cursory reading of his autobiography as well, Philby's autobiography, My Silent War, that he went through some sort of crisis at the end of the 1930s when, to quote his book, he writes, "It was clear that much was going badly wrong in the Soviet Union." This was the time of the show trials. "And he considered dropping out of the struggle to which he had committed himself. In the end, he decided to stick it out rather than join the ranks of cynical and embittered former leftists, in the confident faith," as he wrote, "that the principles of the revolution would outlive the aberrations of individuals, however enormous." He argued, much later on, in the 1980s, that history had proved him right. And at the end of his life, he was hopeful that in Gorbachev, I have a leader who has justified my years of faith. The real Philby seems to have been far from the two-dimensional vision depicted in so many books. All the same, the demonization continues. And why? Why? Why does this story keep coming back? I'm not sure, but I'll hazard two guesses. First, many people who consider themselves to be liberal in the West, especially in the Anglo-American world, I think, have for a long time now had a problem with those who make a commitment to an ideological or religious cause, even if that commitment is driven by revulsion against injustice. This skepticism has, if anything, intensified since the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the so-called end of history. Yet those who do make such a commitment need not be blind to a cause's intellectual weaknesses, nor to crimes and horrors committed in its name. It is likely that Philby would have appreciated the sentiments of Dr. Maggio, the communist doctor in Graham Greene, his friend Graham Greene's The Comedians. As Maggio it says at one point, pages 285 to 6 of my edition of the book, actually, Penguin. Catholics and communists have committed great crimes, but at least they have not stood aside like an established society and been indifferent. Secondly, Philby turned against the ruling class of which he was a part, one he saw presiding in the 1920s and 30s over grotesque social inequality and chasing after a long-term political and economic deal with Nazi Germany. And it certainly was, because I've spent some years writing a book about that, actually. It is not easy to see how it could be argued that he betrayed the British people, especially in view of his wartime work, for which he was awarded an OBE, and his part both in preventing a United States, a US nuclear monopoly, and informing Moscow about Western interventions, or a general plan and design for Western interventions in the Soviet bloc, which were doomed anyway, and only likely to result in widespread bloodshed and instability. These, however, were serious offences against the British state and those who ran it. Post-war Britain remained an imperial power with a global network of political and economic interests and strategic bases designed to keep them secure. Designed to keep the economic interests secure. These interests and bases were not directly threatened, not usually directly threatened by the Soviet Union, but their stability as British assets was endangered by communist ideology, while the Anglo-American Alliance, established in 1941 and continued, of course, after the war, helped to provide Britain with the resources needed to sustain these commitments. In his role as what Milne calls a lookout man for Soviet intelligence, Philby made a contribution to blunting Western attempts to weaken the citadel of international communism in Moscow when, in view of his background, education, class, and accent, he should have been doing exactly the opposite. It was this failure not only to play the game gentlemen like him were expected to play, but to engage in covertly subverting the game, which lies behind his reputation as a cad and a bounder. The old ruling class from which Philby came was, of course, eclipsed for a generation after 1945. But, along with its stenographers in the media, it returned to power in 1979. This it continues to hold, no longer with fantasies of presiding over an empire on which the sun never set, but with delusions of running a global Britain based on the wealth of Singapore on Thames. As long as it stays in control with all its mendacity, malevolence and hypocrisy, Kim Philby will continue to be depicted as the bad boy, the flashman of modern Britain. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that Singapore on the Thames. It's hilarious. there are many people here who have given a lot of thought to Kim Philby, so I just wonder if we have time for a few questions. You have a transportation issue arising at 1245. It's 1205, just
okay.
So you know.
Okay, fine, great.
Would someone like to ask a question? Yes.
Thank you very much. Good morning. My name is Morris Cool. 1944, Graham Greene was a member of Section 5.
Yes.
His boss was Kim Philby.
Yes.
Kim Philby was working hard to become the boss of the new Section 9.
Yes.
Which was the anti-Soviet. It has been said that he invited Greene to join him in Section 9. And Greene declined.
Mm.
And Greene retired or resigned from the SIS in 1944, it is said, on the eve of the D-Day landings.
Mm-hmm.
After that, Greene maintained a good friendship with Philby, as they had had before. They socialized, they enjoyed each other's company. And Greene ultimately went to visit him in Russia as well.
Mm.
Can we throw any light on why it was that Greene resigned in 44 and did not join Philby in Section 9?
I can only reiterate what Greene himself said, which was that he, having known Philby and become friendly with him, detected a note of sort of personal ambition and Machiavellian office politics in the plot to take over and run Section 9 that he found rather distasteful and didn't want to have anything to do with it. That's what Greene says. And that when it turned out, after all, that Philby was doing this for a political motive, Greene's objections and worries about Philby's conduct all fell away completely and his old friendship was resumed. I can't say any more about it than that because obviously one can speculate about this. There are loads of things you can think about why Greene really resigned, if that is really if what he gave in his autobiography or in other accounts as well is really what happened, is really what he felt. It sounds a bit thin to me, but quite honestly, I've got nothing else to go on. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I just wonder if part of the caricature of Philby, which you're pushing against, is because he's seen to be the personification of those sort of Cambridge spies, Cambridge traitors. Maclean's too boring, Burgess was too much of a drunk. So because he was charismatic and so on, it was more, he's become that face.
Yeah.
And that's part of the caricature. And there was even an awful Michael Caine film, I remember, from the 50s, and Philby turns up at the beginning as the, you know, KGB colonel.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think, I just wonder if that's, he's become the, you know, human beings, we like to put a face to things, and he's become that face, hence...
Well, I suppose he was a more normal figure, a more immediately relatable figure than the others, who are Blunt as well. We're all Blunt and Burgess and Maclean were all a little bit strange in their various ways, I suppose you could say. Burgess, obviously. Maclean had a series of terrible crack-ups and breakdowns in the late 1940s. And Blunt was a very austere and sort of character, difficult to approach. So from the point of view of human accessibility and normality, I suppose there is that side to Philby, which the others don't have. Yeah. Fair enough.
Thank you very much, it was very interesting.
Thank you.
I've read a number of the books you've mentioned in your speech. One thing I'm surprised about is, why is Ben McIntyre allowed to get away with many inaccuracies that you've mentioned and highlighted?
It's because people are... There's a kind of intellectual laziness, I think, in this, that people don't delve too hard. They think they know the story, and they just recycle a lot of old hat. And much of it is deeply misleading and oversimplified and downright wrong. But it has been from the start, much of it, because a lot of the official Filby story was based on leaks and deliberate lies given to journalists by people in the CIA and MI6, which were then found their way into the newspapers. And now what will happen is that these just get permanently recycled. I think that's part of it. And because it fits, Filby has sort of come to play a part, is a character, which is totally detached from the real Kim Philby. And McIntyre is actually writing about a fictional character, not about a human being who really lived and existed, if you see what I mean. And he's allowed to get away with appalling stuff. I mean, I read his book, and I've got, you know, there are quite a few very fundamental mistakes in it. But I'm not going to go through them all now. But anyone who bothers to take the time to go through it will find that the book is littered with mistakes, many of them simply repeating stuff which was published years ago. And it's just all being recycled time and again. It comes out in newspaper reports as well.
Okay, well, thank you. It's disappointing because he acknowledges so many different sources that he supposedly researched himself. So it's disappointing that he's... But anyway, thank you.
I've admired a lot of Ben McIntyre's work over the years, but I'm afraid not this.
Could I just follow up that a little bit? Could you say a little bit about the decision of Philby to go to Moscow from Beirut and the decision not to bring him back to the UK when there was that period where both options seemed to be on the table?
I think that it's endless. Well, I think basically my own theory of that is SIS didn't want him back in London because it would be deeply embarrassing and difficult to deal with him. And if he did come back, of course, from his point of view, he would have been permanently badgered by people like Peter Wright and others, interrogating him about his past and asking him to spill the beans on colleagues and turn into an informant, which would effectively meant a betrayal of everything that he'd stood for. And although he must have been, because he was a deeply English person, and there were a lot of things about England that he loved very much, but it must have been very tempting for him. But at the end of the day, he was not prepared to sell out as far as he was concerned and betray everything he stood for. I think that's why he went.
The other day I was reading... I'm sorry, did Nick...
I just wanted to ask, my father was head of station in Istanbul after, I can't remember the order, but I seem to recall there was a chap called John Teague and Nicholas Elliott himself and Philby
yes.
Earlier. my father said was responsible prior to that, along with his deputy, of actually carrying out the training of the young men who were dropped into Albania.
Yeah.
And he certainly understood that Philby was responsible, who was his immediate superior at that time, for betraying their identities and enabling their deaths, which he understood to have been pretty much all of the 120 or so people they dropped in. And for him, it was a particular blow personally. And in Philby's book, My Silent War, there's a passage where he describes the killing of these people, saying that they were intent on their own mayhem and murder in Albania, and that it was a war and it was a justifiable action. That seems to imply that he had the same idea, that he was responsible, that he needed to defend it.
It certainly implies that he felt that it was right to try and stop the operation, and he did. What I was saying really is that I personally, on the basis of what I've read and the correspondence with Philip Knightley, who probably knew more about Philby than many people, and stayed in touch with him until he died, and had a lot of contacts, as you've seen with the various sources of intelligence networks all over Europe. It simply wasn't that it was not. I wasn't saying that Philby was unsympathetic to the Operation Valuable, but more that he was not in a position to provide, from what I've learned, the nuts and bolts, landing times, drop zones, identifiers that he's accused of doing, but simply when he was able to telling the Soviets what was going on. That's about it. Particularly, of course, if the operation was penetrated by Albanian security service people, they would have had that information much more at their fingertips than any senior intelligence official who may have been a bit removed from, would have known the general strategic pattern, but wouldn't necessarily have simply been able to deliver the nuts and bolts of it. And would not have wished to incriminate himself by starting up a paper trail which would lead all the way back to him.
It's 20 minutes after 12, and I'm wondering, do you have time for one more question?
Yes, yes, of course.
In which case, I'll indulge myself and ask that question. The other day I was reading the relatively new biography of John Cairncross, and in it, he refers to something that I didn't reflect on very much myself, that Morris Oldfield, as C, was actually fairly content to have Graham Greene go see Philby in Moscow in the hope that maybe Philby would give some ground and even come back.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering about that. Does that not indicate, perhaps, that Philby wasn't an MI6 plant in the KGB?
Maybe. I mean, I'm... Of course, Green did, as we know. He went out to Moscow in the end after Oldfield had died. And he saw Philby several times. And there's actually a play, an interesting play written about all this, called Splinter of Ice, isn't it? Which some of you have probably seen. It's a reconstruction, an imagined reconstruction by Ben Brown, the dramatist, of what happened when Green went to see Philby. They sort of rolled up about three visits into one encounter. But it's an intelligent piece of work and a very interesting one, a very well acted drama, the one I saw as well. And I think from what I remember in it, Green does say to Philby, you know, you'll be well, you can come home if you want to. Philby's answer to him by that stage is that his health wouldn't allow it. He had heart trouble and, you know, it just wasn't feasible. So, which was, he did have heart trouble, of course, and died of heart trouble. So, I think it would have been interesting if he'd come back, but I would have thought a condition would have been a total secrecy, wouldn't it? Not turning it into a propaganda triumph for the West, because that would have sabotaged the entire thing, wouldn't it?
Sounds like it could make a great movie, an alternative reality.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
And I think we truly should let you go, because we don't want you missing your ride.
That's very kind, thank you.
I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.